Yeah, thanks so much for the introduction from the upper right-hand corner of the room. I'm Chris Capiello. I'm a postdoc at Queen's University. I'm working with Joe as well as Aaron Vincent and other people there. And I'm going to talk again about probing strongly interacting and composite and super heavy dark matter. Most of this work is stuff that I did as a grad student at Ohio State, but some of it's stuff that we're finishing up right now with collaborators. So, obligatory intro slide, dark matter makes up 85% of the mass in the universe and we don't know what it is. There are all different ways to search for it, from collider searches to indirect detection and astrophysical and cosmological probes, as well as direct detection. And most of what I talk about today is going to be direct detection or sort of in the context of direct detection. Now, for people who don't think about direct detection every day, these are limits on the dark matter nucleon cross-section as a function of the dark matter mass. And most of the limits and results that I show are going to be on these same sort of axes. And what this figure shows is that direct detection experiments are extremely sensitive to weakly interacting sort of GeV scale dark matter. And the name of the game in direct detection is to push these limits either to lower cross-section or lower mass or both. But what people don't think about quite as often when looking at these limits is how high in cross-section they're valid. So first of all, why would these limits not be valid at arbitrarily large cross-section? And one reason that people have known about for decades and that has been talked about and discussed and written about a lot in recent years is attenuation in the Earth. Direct detection experiments are often built deep underground, which is great because it cuts down on things like cosmogenic backgrounds. But the problem is, if you're looking for strongly interacting dark matter, you can reach a point where your cross-section is so large that the dark matter would scatter with nuclei in the Earth's crust or even the atmosphere or detector shielding before ever reaching the detector, and it'll get scattered away or lose energy and slow down so that it can't trigger your detector anymore. These figures are taken from a paper by Bradley Cavanaugh. And if you look at the blue curve here, this is a ceiling, so-called the maximum cross-section to which a detector is sensitive for CDMS. And what Cavanaugh's work and a number of other papers in the last several years have shown is that for sort of GeV-ish scale dark matter, underground detectors can't probe cross-sections larger than something like 10 to the minus 30 square centimeters. So if you want to get to larger cross-sections than that, what do? Well, the most obvious thing is don't look at underground detectors. If you have way less attenuation, then you can get to larger cross-sections. And there have been a couple experiments in the last few years that have run surface runs, so detectors at the surface of the Earth. One of them is CREST, and you can see that that allows it to get to larger cross-sections. There's a more recent one by Edelweiss. But if you want to get even higher than that, then you have to start looking at high-altitude detectors. So if you want to get to cross-sections that are so large that even the atmosphere would start deflecting dark matter, you can look at, for example, XQC is one that's been analyzed at least three different times now. The X-ray quantum calorimetry experiment, which went up on a sounding rocket, so had very little atmospheric shielding. There are also limits from the Skylab plastic etch detectors that have been analyzed to set limits on dark matter, and a number of other high altitude and balloon-borne experiments. You can put together sort of this patchwork of limits on strongly interacting dark matter. Now, if you want to go even higher than this, to the point where even, you know, a little bit of residual atmospheric shielding or shielding around the instrument itself would be a problem, then you have to start looking at astrophysics and cosmology. Now, this is an old-ish paper. It's like 15 years old at this point, so it doesn't have the most recent astrophysical and cosmological limits, but you can also look at things like dark matter scattering with nuclei and galactic gas clouds, cooling those clouds, and look at distortions to the CMB, effects on the Milky Way satellite galaxy population, and other things. And so you can create this sort of stack of limits where you have underground detectors, followed by high altitude detectors, followed by astrophysical and cosmological probes in order to cover up basically this whole parameter space. Just as a quick aside, the paper that I actually took this figure from is by my old advisor, John Beacom, as well as some collaborators, where they show that if dark matter is strongly interacting enough, it can get captured in the Earth, fall toward the center of the Earth, annihilate, and produce heat. And by the non-observation of this anomalous heat flow, you can set limits on strongly interacting dark matter. Again, this is a somewhat old paper, but just in the last couple of years, a few groups have looked at similar ideas again, including a paper by Joe Bramante's group.
Is there a unitary deadline somewhere here?
That's sort of something that I'm going to talk about, is the a version of a unitarity bound and where some of these things break down. So you've actually gotten slightly ahead of me. What I was going to say is, that's great, we have this whole list of different experiments and different ways of probing the strongly interacting parameter space. But what I'm going to talk about in the first part of my talk is that a lot of these analyses, a lot of these calculations have been done incorrectly. I'm going to talk about the assumptions that go into them, where those assumptions break down, and sort of how you go beyond that. So,
can I ask you, maybe you were going to talk about it, but then, so with these cross-sections, are these things like NFW, like dark matter in the galaxy, or? Isn't it just like a really different?
So this line right here, what's called Milky Way disk disruption, that's similar to what you're talking about. The idea of that bound is that if dark matter is this strongly interacting, it'll scatter so much with the interstellar medium that it sort of puffs up the ISM and disrupts the disk of the galaxy.
Just dark matter itself won't be NFW because these are nuclear cross sections and even darker, right? So can you even compute bounds when you don't even know how it's distributed in the galaxy?
Right. So this is something that I know members of Glenys Farrar's group were looking at, that the dark matter would scatter so much with the ISM and gas in the galaxy that it would get sort of spun up along with the disk, and this would mess up the detection rate and the shape of the dark matter profile. I don't know that they ever... Yeah.
So the y-axis here is dark matter nuclear scatter. So it's not, you know, technically one-to-one with dark matter self-scattering. But let's make it one-to-one for a second, just because, yeah, you have a point. I mean, such a large cross-section, probably.
There's more dark matter than
the bound on dark matter self interactions then would be like something like mx over functions gram per centimeter squared or something like that, or that's roughly parametrically where it sits. So that would be like approximately 10 to the minus 22 or 23 at GV, and then scaled up.
Yeah, so that's around here somewhere.
Disruption line as well for similar reasons. So yeah, if you're trying to do just like a straight self-interaction bound, you definitely place it on here, but it is in the green region. Yeah.
Okay, it's still there.
But yeah. How does structure formation equilibrating with the variance and changing the way dark matter clusters because you have the sound speed?
Yeah, so this is, I'm going to skip ahead a tiny bit. So this, what we call cosmology here, this is from a recent paper by Nadler et al., where they showed that if dark matter and baryons scatter too much, it will mess up the Milky Way satellite galaxy population. So that's roughly where that sort of smallish scale structure bound shows up, if that's your question.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there other questions on that, or should I go ahead? So I'll back up in just a second. So the first part of my talk is basically large cross-sections are dead with a very large asterisk. And this is based on work that I did with my former colleague, Matt Digman, who's now a postdoc at Montana State. My advisor was John Beacom, and then a couple other professors at Ohio State. And I'm going to start this part of my talk by talking about the assumptions that typically go into direct detection, and particularly that go into all of the limits that I showed earlier. So the first simplest assumption is that dark matter is point-like. For this part of my talk, I'm not going to talk about composite dark matter. We assume that it interacts with nuclei via a contact interaction or via a mediator that's heavy enough that you can treat it as a contact interaction. And for this part of my talk, I'm going to focus on spin-independent dark matter nucleus scattering. So there are lots of different effective operators that you could write down, but spin-independent scattering is sort of the most commonly assumed one, and it's the one that's shown in this limit. If you want to model dark matter attenuation in the Earth, and you want to understand how it affects your direct detection limits, you need some way to relate the dark matter nucleus cross-section for scattering on nuclei in the Earth, things like oxygen and silicon, with the cross-section for scattering on whatever your detector is made of, xenon, argon, germanium, what have you. And for spin-independent scattering, we have this very nice simple scaling relation, which says that the dark matter nucleus cross-section is equal to the dark matter nucleon cross-section times some proportionality factor. And when the dark matter is very heavy, that proportionality factor is just a to the four, where a is the mass number. So if in this talk I mentioned the a to the four scaling, I'm more properly talking about this full scaling. I'm just using it as a shorthand.
Sorry, where does the additional factor of a squared come again?
This factor or this?
The a to the four?
Yeah.
The a squared for the coherent scattering, the a to
right.
The four, the additional factor of a squared comes?
Yeah, so this mu squared divided by mu squared, if the dark matter is very, very heavy, then you know this is just the mass of the nucleus, this is the mass of a nucleon, so that ratio becomes a factor of a squared. Is that what you're asking, or are you asking where this factor?
I can explain later, I don't want to interrupt, it's just something I'm missing, but continue, please.
How light is mediator actually in your proper space? How light can be? Or if you put only one copy, how heavy or how light can the mediator be? Is the assumption that the mediator is heavy a good assumption?
So basically, we're assuming that the mediator is heavy enough that the range of the mediator is small compared to the size of the nucleus. So, you know, order GeV. Or heavier.
And that's fulfilled in the parameter space that you're...
Yeah, that's this whole parameter space. I have a slide later on where I talk about limits on sub-GeV mediators and what constraints matter for those. But this is great because if you make all of these assumptions, then you have this nice simple scaling relation that lets you relate the dark matter nucleus cross-sections for all different nuclei, which lets you compare different direct detection experiments to one another. It lets you talk about attenuation on one nucleus and detection with another nucleus in a way that sort of makes sense. So what's the problem here? Well, the problem is that this scaling relation depends on the validity of the Born approximation, which fails badly by the time you get to cross-sections this large. And to explain why, I'm going to model a nucleus as just a simple spherical top hat potential with a magnitude of V naught and a radius that's proportional to, you know, a Fermi times about the mass number to the 1/3. If you look at this top right plot, what we're showing here is the dark matter nucleus cross-section for scattering on helium as a function of that potential V naught. And if the Born approximation were always valid, you would get this green dashed line, where the cross-section just goes like V naught squared. However, we know that this is an approximation. And that approximation breaks down when the potential is too strong. And so if we want to look at strong potentials, we can instead solve this problem using a partial wave expansion. And when we do that, we notice two things. One is that the Born approximation result fails when the potential is very large. And two, the approximation fails in different ways depending on whether the potential is attractive or repulsive. So in the orange here, you see the result for an attractive potential with these characteristic resonances. And for a repulsive potential, you see the blue curve, which asymptotes. And it asymptotes at about 4 pi r squared, where r is the radius of the nucleus. This 4 pi r squared is what I'm going to call the geometric limit. And this is not a new result by any means. I mean, you can find this in a quantum mechanics textbook talking about scattering theory. But it gives us a useful way to think about where and why that a to the 4 scaling breaks down. Because if we go back to this figure, let's pick a dark matter mass that's significantly larger than a nucleus so that we can just say that the scaling is a to the 4. You know, let's say a dark matter mass of a TeV. This ceiling at around a TeV is, say, 10 to the minus 28 square centimeters, and that's the dark matter nucleon cross section. If we plug that in here and then say that our detector is made out of xenon, a to the 4 for xenon is a few times 10 to the 8. And so if we want to calculate the dark matter xenon cross-section, we get 10 to the 8 times 10 to the minus 28, something like 10 to the minus 20 square centimeters. Now, the bottom panel of this figure is for xenon, where the top panel is for helium. And what you see is that that 10 to the minus 20 square centimeter value is orders of magnitude larger than the geometric cross-section for xenon. What that means is that if you're trying to get to cross-sections that large, your a to the 4 scaling and the Born approximation have both just completely broken down, and so that scaling doesn't work anymore. Another way to parameterize this is instead of showing the dark matter nucleus cross-section versus V, we can show the dark matter nucleus cross-section versus the dark matter nucleon cross-section. And we'll do this specifically for a repulsive interaction because the attractive interaction with all these resonances looks very messy and non-monotonic. So for a repulsive interaction, nucleus cross-section versus nucleon cross-section, you see at small cross-sections, this mu squared a squared scaling works perfectly well. But then when you make the you make the cross-section too large, that scaling breaks down, and it breaks down at different points for different nuclei. You'll also see on the far right side, I've drawn this big red caution line. That is the geometric cross-section for a nucleon. So if we model a nucleon, a proton, a neutron, as just a spherical top hat potential with a radius of order a Fermi, you cannot get a repulsive potential larger than something like 10 to the minus 25 square centimeters. So what that means is that we can divide this parameter space I showed before into three different regions. At small cross-sections, the scaling that we're used to is totally okay. And that's good because this is where direct detection collaborations usually report their results anyway. In this intermediate region, which is where some of these high altitude detectors exist and where some calculations of the ceiling have been done, we say that the scaling is uncertain. Depending on what nucleus you're looking at, the a to the 4 scaling may or may not be a good approximation of how the cross-section behaves. And then when you're above around 10 to the minus 25 square centimeters, we say here it cannot be point-like dark matter, with the asterisk that this is for a repulsive contact interaction. So what does that top panel mean? Does it mean that large cross-sections just are impossible? No one think about them, you can't have them? Well, not really, because there are a couple caveats to this. One is something I've talked about already, which is that if you have an attractive potential, you can get resonances that push you above that geometric cross-section. So technically, you can get cross-sections above that geometric limit, but you run into a number of problems. One, there's no longer a reliable scaling between the cross-sections on different nuclei. Another is you have to sit, you know, relatively close to this to one of these resonances in order to get a cross-section that's much larger. There's a recent paper from Glenys Farrar's group where they look at the attractive potential in a lot more detail, and they actually show, interestingly, that when you're sitting near one of these resonances, your cross-section can become velocity dependent, even if there's no explicit velocity dependence at the level of your effective operator. So you can do this, it just gets very messy, and you're still limited by a unitarity bound, which for typical dark matter masses and velocities is around the top of this figure. It's like 10 to the minus 21 or so square centimeters. Another way you could try to get around this is with light mediators. Everything we've been talking about here has been based on a contact interaction, but what if you have a mediator that just has a range that's much longer than the radius of a nucleus? And you can do this, but this scenario is subject to many different constraints, from stellar cooling, BBN, meson decay, fifth force constraints, nuclear scattering constraints. And theorists can definitely come up with models where one or more of these constraints don't apply, or you can argue that some of these limits are too strong and aren't quite as strong as is shown here. But if you take these limits at face value, and these are from a recent review on light dark matter, if you take these limits at face value, you can't get anywhere close to that geometric cross-section. And in fact, even if you just declare that any one of these limits is invalid and you can completely get around it, you still can't get a cross-section that's more than a couple orders of magnitude larger than that geometric limit. But there is a third way that I've mentioned indirectly, which is you could have dark matter be a composite particle. Everything I've talked about so far has been based on point-like dark matter, but what if dark matter is composite and just has a radius that is larger than that of a nucleus? In this case, you could get around that geometric cross-section because now you're limited not by the size of the nucleus, but the size of your composite dark matter particle. And in this part of the talk, I'm going to focus on, a fairly simple and fairly extreme model where the composite particle is so strongly interacting that it's just opaque to nuclei, so that its cross-section is of order just pi r squared. This is an idea that has been thought about before, and constraints have been set on this before. It's been referred to as macroscopic dark matter. There are some limits from Skylab, which I mentioned earlier, limits from ancient mica, which is something I'll talk about a little bit later. Some of the cosmological limits don't really care whether dark matter is composite or point-like, and if it's scattering on hydrogen, it doesn't matter that a to the four scaling is breaking down. So there are constraints on this. And we could also take a bunch of underground detector limits and traditional direct detection limits and just recast them as limits on composite dark matter. But there are complications to doing that, which I'll talk about in a couple minutes, but for the moment, I just want to say that, you know, we know that these underground detector limits are not designed to apply to composite dark matter. So what we do is just show the limits on point-like dark matter along with this geometric cross-section and say, you know, these limits are not valid above here, and these limits need to be recast for composite dark matter. Now, to try to probe this parameter space, we got in touch with Juan Coyar at the University of Chicago. And you notice that these cross-sections are quite large, and this brings me back to the issue of attenuation that I talked about earlier in my talk. If you want to probe very large cross-sections, you want to be near the surface of the Earth or sort of have as little attenuation, as little shielding as you can, because otherwise the dark matter could just get blocked before it reaches your detector. And it turned out that Professor Coyar has exactly the detector for us. He has exactly what we were looking for. This is...
That's a question like this. So for your like I guess if I'm talking about a sigma chi pi, are you assuming that the cross section is the same?
No, we're making no assumption about the dark matter self-interaction cross section.
So, are there models you can build where the dark matter interacts with nucleons, which is a geometric cross section, but not with the cell?
Not really. And again, we Joe actually helped out earlier. If we go way back to this figure, if you think about the dark matter constraints on dark matter self-interaction, that cross section, that limit is somewhere up here, right? So it doesn't get down into the region of direct detection constraints that we're looking at. Is that what you're asking?
I'm just wondering, in that case, how that is related, because when you have a composite, right, naively, the interaction with the matter scales as how many composite particles, constituents in the composite particle square, right? But the self-interaction between the dark particles as that number to the fourth power, right?
Well, if you're thinking about a long-range force, you could worry about that. But if these are just blobs that have, interactions just defined by the physical extent, then actually the cross-section on the y-axis should be exactly the cross-section for themselves, right?
So that's why I'm asking. So if you're assuming sigma chi chi is also equal to pi chi squared.
Yeah, that's the simplest assumption you can make. You could fiddle around with this a little bit, but yeah, the simplest assumption is that this stuff is just opaque to standard model particles or to itself. And then if you have a self-interaction cross-section that's limited to, order centimeters squared per gram, then you get limits that are sort of vaguely up here.
The Italians have been doing this forever, Michele has been working on this stuff forever, this self-interacting stuff, and he says all these guys, maybe they Google or something in some cases.
Yeah, but that's much lower masses, right? I mean, Michele goes up to 6 dB. That's the most,
So the question is, have you checked that? What are the actual, particle physics models that people have written down?
So I'll skip to the very end because I've got a backup slide that talks about this. The main model that I have in mind when I think about this very heavy stuff comes from a couple papers on dark quark nuggets. So the idea here is that, for a little bit of background, if you go back to the 1980s, Witten showed that if QCD had a first order phase transition, you could get these quark nuggets, these large baryon number blobs of quark matter in the early universe. We know that QCD doesn't have that required phase transition, but theorists have thought about, okay, what if the dark sector has some analog of QCD where you tune the parameters a little bit so that you do get a first order phase transition, and then you can get these very large blobs of sort of dark quark-like matter. And that's the limit from, or not limit, but the results from this paper are shown in this figure where they're talking about, very large masses and quite large cross-sections. There's a similar idea from a paper a couple years ago, what they call Fermi balls, which are view of dark matter fermions that get trapped in a false vacuum during a phase transition in the early universe. You can get a similar sort of large composite blob of fermionic dark matter. So those are the kinds of models that I'm thinking about. And to answer your question again, I have no reason to expect that, the dark matter self-interaction cross-section would be much different than the dark matter standard model cross-section. I'm assuming that these are basically just opaque blobs.
I remember reviewing one of these dark quark nugget papers, and I vaguely, very vaguely remember that one of the problems was that it was really hard to calculate the critical abundance, the abundance of the things that are in nuggets, or that they assemble into bigger nuggets.
It's not that.
Yeah.
That, So there's the first work on this recently by like Mark Russell, Lazenby, and West in like 2014. And there they did like a basic parametric estimate. But then when you do more complicated BBNS calculations where you actually look what's built up, you find that that estimate is pretty close. So it's true that, you know, when you have these dark curve packets, they're going to have a mass spectrum. But the simple estimate you do that just looks at the rate of their assembly in the early universe and says, when does that assembly shut off as a function of quark nugget number? It'll get you within, it'll get you the right order of magnitude for the masses. Yeah.
So the cosmology of these things is more or less robust?
Yeah, I would say, you know, you can come up, just like in BBN, you can come up with more and more precise calculations. You should be able to get things to within or in order to actually the right mass for them, you know, when you specify the dark current couplings and their couplings to whatever scalar field or whatever other binding field you're talking about.
Yeah, and they do talk about, so here, this line down here says that if you try to go too low in mass and cross-section, you do, as well as these quark nuggets, you do get dark baryons, and at some point you mess up the dark matter relic abundance just with your dark baryons. So that is a thing that happens and that they've calculated here. Does that answer your question? So I'm going to go back to, okay. Yeah, so this is the picture I was showing of Professor Koyar's detector. The nice thing about this is it's not a kilometer underground like a lot of direct detection experiments. It's in a basement lab, so it's under, you know, a couple meters of concrete, and that's all the shielding, that and the atmosphere. Now, you might worry about something that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, which is cosmogenic backgrounds. If you have a detector that's near the surface of the Earth, how do you deal with lots of backgrounds that are affecting you at the surface? And that's where the design of this detector is really ingenious. It's a two-cell liquid scintillator detector. So the idea is that dark matter comes in approximately vertically, scatters in one cell, deposits energy, scatters in the second cell and deposits energy, and you can measure the time delay between those interactions. And so the time delay for a dark matter particle traveling at around 10 to the minus 3 C is order a couple of microseconds, whereas for relativistic backgrounds, it's of order a couple nanoseconds. Now, you might worry about the requirement that dark matter scatter multiple times, because for a typical direct detection experiment, you know, you're lucky if dark matter scatters once. But remember, we're talking about very strongly interacting dark matter, so this ends up not being a problem at all. In fact, in order to trigger the detector, in order to produce enough scintillation light, we need the dark matter not to scatter once in each cell, not to scatter twice, but to scatter at least 50 times in order to be above threshold, which again sounds like a tall order, but at the cross sections we're looking at, it's totally fine. So this detector was run in two separate configurations by Professor Koyar for about 60 days each. The only difference between the two configurations was that in one run there was some additional lead shielding above the top. In the second run, that lead shielding was removed. And what you see, I'll just look at the top figure for now. The red histogram is an example dark matter spectrum, and this is number of counts as a function of the time delay. And again, you see the dark matter is centered at, you know, 1 to 2 microseconds, whereas virtually all of the background events, several thousand of them, are at, you know, smaller than that, order nanoseconds or less than a microsecond. And so what we do in our analysis is we define an analysis threshold of 0.8 microseconds. If the time delay is less than 0.8 microseconds, then the event we say is background. If it's above 0.8 microseconds, it's a dark matter candidate event. And by doing that, we are able to set this limit on strongly interacting dark matter. So our limit is the shaded red region. I'll go through each edge of this region sort of in order. The top of this region is set just by attenuation in the Earth, in, well, I should say, the Earth's atmosphere or the shielding above the detector. The bottom of this region is set by the energy threshold. Remember, we required dark matter to scatter at least 50 times in each cell in order to be detected. If the cross-section is too small, it just doesn't scatter enough to trigger the detector. And the right side of this region is set basically by the exposure. If you know the mass density of dark matter in the galaxy, then if you make the particle mass very large, make the dark matter mass very large, the number density goes down, which means that the flux goes down. And so to the right of this line, you basically don't expect to see anything passing through the detector in our exposure time. Now, the difference between this dashed vertical line and the solid vertical line is everything to the left of the dashed line is excluded by both runs that we did. The space between the two lines is excluded only by the run with the additional lead shielding. And the reason is that when Professor Coyard did the run without the lead shielding, there was exactly one event that was observed that fell in our region of interest that had a large enough time delay. And so that weakened our limit slightly in that run. But going on from there, so I mentioned before that we didn't rescale any of these underground detector limits, and I'll talk about the reason now. The reason is that in this analysis, we required dark matter to scatter multiple times in the detector in order to deposit enough energy. This actually ends up being a big problem for direct detection experiments, because if you're running an experiment like Lux or Xenon or what have you, if you see a multi-scatter event, you're likely to just throw it out as a standard model background, because that's not how you expect WIMPs to behave. So there is some cross-section above which standard direct detection analyses are not sensitive, because they would have thrown out these events. This wasn't something that we looked at, but luckily soon after we wrote our paper, this was something that Joe's group looked at, and they recast a bunch of direct detection limits as limits on composite dark matter, where, just for an example, if we look at the xenon region, there's a sharp cutoff at a cross-section of around 10 to the minus 24 or so square centimeters, where if the cross-section were larger than that, they would have seen multi-scatter or track-like events. And if you look at this whole compilation of exclusion regions, you find that there's a chunk of parameter space here that you actually cannot get to with other existing direct detection limits, direct detection experiments. So what that means is that in this parameter space, you actually needed to take the multi-scatter nature of these particles into account. You needed to do a search for multi-scatter events. And a year or so after this paper came out.
Last question, like for xenon, when you get to the xenon detector, how much, what is roughly the amount you slow down?
Oh, how much do you slow down, in the Earth?
Yeah.
So for this part of the parameter space, you don't worry about slowing down at all. In this part of the parameter space, dark matter is so heavy that at that cross-section, it's not going to slow down at all. You just see a track of events in the detector, so it gets thrown out because of that. This line right here is an overburden calculation. So this is, along this line, dark matter would slow down significantly. And when I say, so this gray line right here, that's the attenuation ceiling of the xenon one-ton region. And when you ask how much it slows down, it kind of depends how you model this. People use everything from very simple analytic approximations to complicated Monte Carlo simulations. But it also depends on the dark matter mass. You know, if the dark matter is very light, then you're only sensitive to the high velocity tail of the dark matter distribution anyway. So if it slows down just a little bit, then you lose a lot of event rate. Whereas, you know, for relatively heavy dark matter, it could lose half of its kinetic energy and still be able to trigger the detector.
I see. So may I ask, for your experiment, what's the energy that's deposited?
Deposited in the detector?
Yeah.
It is, so we require 50-ish collisions on protons traveling at 10 to the minus 3 C. So each proton recoil has energy of order a keV. So deposited energy has to be at least around 50 keV.
Why proton?
So the liquid scintillator that we use is made up of, it's an organic liquid scintillator, so it's made of protons and carbon nuclei. And because we're looking at just a geometric cross-section, because there are more protons than there are carbon nuclei, the total scattering rate on protons is larger than the scattering rate on carbon nuclei. You also have to worry about the quenching factor. So when you have a nuclear recoil in a scintillator, only some fraction of that energy turns into scintillation light. And that fraction depends heavily on the nucleus you're looking at. And carbon is much more heavily quenched than protons. We could have done this if we had done this analysis looking just at carbon recoils rather than just proton recoils, we would have gotten a slightly weaker limit. And if we combined them, it would have gotten marginally stronger, but not even visible on this plot with how large the axis range is. Does that answer your question? Okay.
I'm still a bit slow on the model, sorry for this, but what about the, so there's in an actual home, there's also an interaction of nuclei with themselves, just because you are opening your dark matter nuclei with something, or so there will be also nuclear cells covering nuclear stuff. So are there bonds from that are very strong? Because you want to make that opening as small as possible so that you don't get killed because of that, and make the dark matter copy to that mediator as large as possible to make the other one as small as possible, and be consistent at the same time with dark matter salt interactions, something like that. I guess that's the game that you're playing.
Yeah, so
it's much of a game though, because you keep talking about the, when you say the nuclear interactions, you're talking about dark matter and dark matter interactions still, right?
No. So anything, the nucleus itself will hold to something because you're putting some copy to the dark matter to the nucleus, right?
Okay.
Yeah, so there's like a crossing symmetry.
You write an engaging variable, it's quark, Higgs, and something else, right, that you're putting, there's something that you're putting there, and that something cannot have a very small copy because you really want large cross sections.
Yeah, so we thought about this, I think I have this backup slide. We thought about this in the context of a light mediator, so this is the result from the first part of my talk broken down into where the scaling fails for different nuclei. This dashed green line was the limit for a light mediator, where we just take all existing constraints on light mediators that we showed at face value. The reason that this gets very, very strong down here is that if you, so at these low masses, because the dark matter self interaction cross section, that limit depends on the dark matter mass. If you basically take the limit on the dark matter self interaction and sort of combine that with limits on nucleus-nucleus scattering, you get, via sort of exactly as you were talking about, limits on the dark matter nucleus cross-section. And so if you combine those limits, you do get a very strong limit here. It wasn't something that we looked into for the sort of approximately contact interaction case.
I see. But
so for the contact you have to, what is the mediator? Like
you
have some like high dimensional operator with some TV cutoff, or like, and then
yeah, so the spin in the terms of non-relativistic effective field theory, there's a particular effective operator you can write down that gives you this spin-independent response. We don't think about it in terms of specific mediators, except that the mediator is heavy enough to not introduce some angular dependence to the scattering.
You know what would be useful to actually, I mean, you can do it after you're done, to write down a complete model
Yeah.
When you show where the thing comes from and how it couples to the standard model.
Mm-hmm.
That would be from start to finish. So because I mean we can continue this discussion afterwards. But it would be useful for us to understand if you can write a microscopic Lagrangian that tells you exactly what's the scale, like fully relativistic, fully gauge invariant, and for the standard model gauge piece of freedom.
Okay.
So
my favorite example actually of one that Herbst and Fitts all about is just if you have a light fermion, like an asymmetric fermion with a light scalar that's binding it together, if you even give a tiny coupling between that light scalar and standard model nuclei, of course, for fermions, you'll end up with a really large potential inside your compiled state.
Yeah.
And if the coupling between that scalar that's sourcing that potential and the standard model is negative, then it will automatically be a repulsive potential. And actually, all the dynamics of this contact interaction are exactly modeled by what's being presented.
But this is tuned, right? Because you need the scalar to be much lighter. This is a scalar coupling, it's not the derivative.
You don't need it to be much lighter. Have like a KV mass scalar, MEV mass scalar, it's fine. The point is that the potential inside the composite is large, and so if you give even a very tiny coupling to the standard model, it'll essentially give you a repulsive barrier to anything coming into the composite state. So you have the same massive composite state, it'll be a repulsive potential right at the surface that basically does not have any nucleus.
Yeah, sorry, but then why don't things, I mean,
what's the constituent of that?
Yes. Yeah.
The constituent mass? You can do it with GV, TV,
constituent masses, whatever you want. It's not a very
important. Sorry,
problem.
So you have GV. Okay, but let's continue this discussion.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be because there's.
I kind of understand the model, but I cannot really do the parametrics in my head because, for instance, if you have GV scalar coming from nucleons, you have really, really strong constraints from just meson.
Oh, yeah, and I should mention this is perfectly fine for subgravitational. Couplings, so like weaker than gravity couplings because of your potential inside your composite is actually so low.
Oh,
yeah.
So let's look at it that way.
Yeah, we can look at it
that way. Yeah, it's just because we don't have that much time.
Sorry for that.
Yeah.
No worries at all. So the last thing I was going to say on this section of the talk is that around a year or so, year or two after our paper came out, the Deep collaboration put out a paper where they did the same sort of multi-scatter analysis that we did. So they recognized that to look for these very large cross-sections, you need to specifically look for multi-scatter or track-like events. And by doing that, they're able to set this exclusion region, which goes all the way up to approximately the Planck mass. So the paper that they put out was something like first direct detection constraints on Planck mass dark matter. And you see that this Chicago region is our limit, and you see that we're able to get to slightly larger cross-sections just because there was not nearly as much attenuation because our detector was at a shallower depth. So for the last part of my talk, I want to talk about searching for even heavier dark matter, because I mentioned that our exclusion region cuts off at a certain mass because if dark matter is too heavy, the flux is just very small. And even for something like deep, which I'll show again, they can't go past approximately the Planck mass because over here the dark matter flux would be so small that you just don't expect to see any particles going through your detector in your exposure time. So in order to get beyond this, you need to look at something beyond traditional direct detection, something that's either much larger or running for a much longer time than we can operate as humans. And there have been a couple ideas about this in the past. One is so-called paleodetection. So I showed this limit from ancient mica earlier. The idea is that there are mica crystals in the Earth that have been around for millions of years. If strongly interacting dark matter passed through those crystals, it would have broken molecular bonds. And what you can do is take these crystals, etch the surface with some reagent, and then with high-powered microscopy, you can search for etch pits that are left when you etch somewhere that these bonds have been broken. And so you can set limits up to sort of the gram scale using these mica searches, changing entirely from long exposure time to large detector area. There's a paper from a couple years ago that looked at bolide cameras. So the idea, these are cameras that are used to search for visible flashes from meteors. The idea here was that if dark matter is heavy enough and strongly interacting enough, it'll deposit so much energy in the atmosphere that it would actually be visible. So you can set limits that way. This last part of my talk is going to be sort of a different take on this meteor idea. And it's based on the idea of radar meteor detection. This is a paper that I'm working on with a former master's student at OSU named Pawan. The idea here, the picture that I'm showing here, is the Middle and Upper Atmosphere Radar Observatory in Japan. The idea behind how meteor radar detection works is that as a meteor passes through the atmosphere, it scatters with atoms in the atmosphere, ionizes those atoms, and that ionization, that plasma, will reflect radio waves. And so you can use radar to search for these meteors and compute how many meteors are reaching the Earth. We want to do the same thing with dark matter. Assume that we have this big composite ball of dark matter. It's passing through the Earth's atmosphere. And as it does so, it ionizes the surrounding air and produces an ionization trail that we can search for. Now, there are two different types of meteors that you can search for, meteor signals you can search for in this way. There are head echoes and trail echoes. A head echo is the radar bouncing off the sort of roughly spherical plasma around the meteor itself. Trail echoes are what they sound like. It's radar bouncing off the long ionization trail that's left behind the meteor, or in our case, the dark matter. And we can look in the right here at the observed flux of trail echoes and head echoes. And what we notice is, if you look at this, this is the number of meteors observed as a function of velocity. The existing data only goes up to a velocity of 70 kilometers per second for trail echoes, and the head echoes go a little bit further off to about 90 kilometers per second, which is very small compared to dark matter, which means that if we want to use this data to set limits on dark matter, we're limited to only the very low velocity tail of the dark matter distribution. So low, in fact, that we have to be careful to take the Earth's gravitational potential into account when figuring out what the velocity distribution of these things would be, which is not something you normally have to worry about for direct detection. So how do we go from, you know, this existing data and some dark matter properties to actual limits on dark matter? Well, we need to start by computing the energy deposition of dark matter in the atmosphere. And what we have here are figures of the energy deposition as a function of altitude. This is, for simplicity, assuming that the dark matter particle is coming straight down through the atmosphere. And let's say that we look at this green curve, which has a cross-section of 10 to the minus 3 square centimeters and 10 to the minus 4 grams. Very large, very heavy compared to what you're used to thinking about for dark matter. What happens is that when the dark matter enters the atmosphere, it's not doing much because the density is very small. The density of the atmosphere falls off approximately exponentially as you go to higher altitude. But then as you reach lower altitude, that density increases exponentially, so the energy deposition increases exponentially until you reach a point where the dark matter has lost most of its energy. And then that energy deposition quickly drops back to zero as the dark matter slows down rapidly. If we instead look at the same mass, but a cross-section that's an order of magnitude larger, we get basically the same shape. It just turns on a little bit sooner. And if instead of that, we take this dashed red curve and look at a mass that's an order of magnitude smaller, we get the energy deposition turning on at the same point because the cross-section is the same, but because the mass is so much lower, it can't deposit that much energy before it slows down. Now, once we know what the energy deposition is, we can compute the electron line density. This is just the number of ionized electrons per unit distance. that's basically just the energy deposition rate divided by the average energy needed to produce an electron-ion pair in the atmosphere. And for a whole range of basically macroscopic dark matter sizes and masses, we get, so 34 eV here is the average energy required to produce an electron-ion pair in air. And for all of this parameter space, we produce an electron line density of at least 10 to the 15 per centimeter, which is sort of a standard number for actual meteor detection. But once we have, this energy loss rate or energy deposition rate, we can compute the electron line density. Once we have the electron line density, so 10 to the 15 is right here, from that, meteor experts know how to compute the radius of the produced plasma. And if the only thing that were happening was we produce ionized electrons and they go diffuse around, then the radius of the plasma would just go like the square root of the total electron line density. But that's not all that's happening. You also have positive ions that recapture these electrons. And so you have to take this reattachment effect into account. And so if you do this as a function of either the electron line density or as a function of altitude, you see that this reattachment effect decreases the size of the signal, decreases the radius of the plasma. But this is, again, something that is well understood by meteor experts, has been worked out before. So as long as we're sure to take this into account, everything works fine. What we then do is compute the flux of dark matter events as a function of the radar cross-section. So the radar cross-section in units, this is decibels per square meter. This is just the size of the log of the size of the radar signal divided by the size of the signal you would get from bouncing off a square meter target. So what we can do is compute the radar cross-section for dark matter with, you know, a certain mass, certain cross-section, and particular velocity, add up over the range of the velocity distribution that we're sensitive to, and then we get a spectrum that looks like this or like this for the spectrum of dark matter-induced events. And basically what we say is that if at any point this dark matter-induced spectrum is larger at the 95% level than the actual observed data, then that mass and cross-section is ruled out. And I'm going a little fast because I think we're out of time. But I just want to point out, remember that we're only sensitive to this very low velocity tail of the dark matter distribution. And it's actually the flux is increasing with velocity rather than decreasing with velocity, which is what you would see if you were looking at the high velocity tail. And that's the reason that these spectra are actually increasing. So you get a larger flux of more detectable signals. But when you put all that together, these are the exclusion regions that we get. The dark red is the exclusion region we get from comparing to head echo data. The sort of light pink or orange is what we get comparing to trail echo data. And these limits themselves, most of that parameter space is already covered by cosmology. But what's really interesting is that we're able to do that looking only at a very small fraction of the dark matter. And so if data existed, if we could go to the radar experts and say, hey, how many meteors do you see that are traveling at 400 kilometers a second, for example, we could extend these regions by orders of magnitude in all different directions, which would let us get down and probe. There's sort of a conspicuous gap between cosmological limits and limits from ancient mica. So we are now out of time, but basically in conclusion, when you want to look for strongly interacting dark matter, there are lots of assumptions that are typically made that break down. And when those assumptions break down, you need to start looking at something very different. And the something that we have settled on is composite dark matter, which you can set limits on using either traditional direct detection or completely different ideas, like using the entire atmosphere as a detection area. So thank you for having me. Thank you again for all of your questions, and I'm happy to take any more that you have.
Thank you.
Hi.
Any Zoom questions?
Dawn, do you have a question?
I don't have any questions here. I don't think there's anyone else connected. So.
Yeah, go ahead.
This isn't super important, but I mean, I can figure out what most of the limits on that graph are, but what are humans and fireworks?
Okay, so those are both papers by Jagjit Singh Sidhu, who was one of Glenn Starkman's students. The fireball, that's just another name for the bolide camera thing that I mentioned before. So dark matter passes through the atmosphere and deposits so much energy that it's like a visible meteor. The human region is this paper that came out a few years ago titled Death by Dark Matter. And their idea was that the human race is a very large detection volume. And if something traveling at 10 to the minus 3 C and weighing like a gram crashes into your head, it would probably leave a detectable signal. So they claimed to set limits on the strongly interacting dark matter based on the, quote, non-observation of unexplained gunshot wounds in the Western world in the last 10 years. There are lots and lots of complaints you could raise about the methodology and statistics of doing this, but nominally that's what their limit looked like.
I think their backgrounds must be pretty large in some regions of the world.
Yeah, you know, the joke when this paper came out was that dark matter killed John F. Kennedy. Other questions?
Let's thank Chris again.